Oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order they are parents, they are docket number 060815, Jesse C. Ingram and Behavioral Psychology Clinic, PC, versus Lewis Deer, DO, and Hillvale Medical Group Association from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 060875, Ford Motor Company versus Ezekiel Castile et al. From Cameron County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. And 060890, Neighbors Drilling USA Inc. versus Francisca Escoto et al. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to complete all three before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060815, Jesse Ingram versus Lewis Deer.
May it please the court, Mr. Enoch will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Court. I'd like to start out with a short story. Dr. Deer, in this case, attended and graduated from medical school over 40 years ago, nearly 50 years ago. He did his residency in Dallas, Texas during the tumultuous 60s. I was called into this case after the trial to prepare a motion for judgment NOV or for a new trial. I read the record in this case and came to the immediate realization that the jury verdict, based on the record, was virtually unexplainable. I appeared at the hearing before Judge Evans, and this is what Judge Evans said. One last comment before I let you all argue is something that you will all not ever find in the record, but occurred during the trial. In my opinion, the number one most impressive thing or most outstanding thing in the jury's mind as they evaluated this case. And that was what started out, in my experience, to be a fairly innocuous question when Mr. Smith asked Dr. Deer, would you tell the ladies and gentlemen, it was something like, you know, when you got your education or, you know, your educational background or something, and Dr. Deer said that in the whatever, was it in the 50s or in the 60s? Which was it? It was in the 50s? I believe so, Mr. Smith responded. The court, yeah, my recollection was the 50s. He told this jury he went through medical college in the 50s. And this courtroom fell silent, and Mr. Smith paused dramatically. Now, pauses don't show on the record, as you all know. We sat here for a second while the jury contemplated the thought that Dr. Deer went through medical college when there were signs over in the records building that said whites only, drinking fountain, and blacks only, drinking fountain, and whites restroom, and blacks restroom. And that set pretty strong with them is my suspicion as they evaluated these two men. And so that's nowhere in the record. That's just one of those credibility issues that the jury has the right and the power to evaluate as it evaluated the testimony of these two doctors. I told the judge then, as I tell you now, number one instruction in a jury instruction is that bias and prejudice plays no role in the decision of the facts of this case. I believe that verdict is explained that way. But we don't have to reach that question, and in fact, the opportunity for a new trial has passed us all by. Interestingly, I don't think the trial judge ever suspected that bias in favor of a witness versus opposed to a witness is just as improper. He ultimately divided the baby in half in the verdict, and then he immediately recused.
Do we have any idea why he recused?
We have no reason to know why he recused. It's not in the record either. But the countenance of the judge changed when I suggested to him bias may have played a role in the verdict in this case. But Dr. Deer ultimately got what he wanted. He wanted a judgment NOV. I suggest to you that as a matter of law, Judge Hartman was correct in granting the judgment, notwithstanding the verdict. And I believe this court's decision in City of Keller versus Wilson decides the two main issues in this case. First, the court cannot disregard contrary evidence that a reasonable jury could not disregard. And a witness whose assumptions are disproven in the trial of the case, an expert witness's opinion is not reliable and therefore no evidence. There is literally no evidence supporting any set of the jury findings in this case. As an example, we can look at the damages question that's here. And we provided an exhibit for you all, and the first page shows the expert, Mr. Ramey's, testimony in this case. The expert, all parties agree, I should say, that Dr. Deere, whatever he was to be paid for whatever services he was to perform, was 20% of the gross revenues. We're not disputing that. Mr. Ramey comes in and projects that the gross revenues over whatever period of time for which the jury awarded 20% to Dr. Deere would have been $25 million. There is no evidence in this record that any income at the clinic even approached half of $25 million. In fact, at the time of trial 2004, when Mr. Ramey is testifying, he projects income for the years for which there is actual records of incomes.
What evidence did they have of an oral agreement that a partnership existed?
Your Honor, I think they have no evidence that a partnership existed. The second page of the exhibit demonstrates that under the Partnership Act, TRIPA, there are five indicators of a partnership.
Does everybody agree that it applies, or there seems to be some confusion about that?
Well, Your Honor, under TRIPA and the comments by the legislature, it applies whether the parties think they have a joint venture or a partnership or whatever arrangement they have. So we believe by the statute under TRIPA, which came into existence in 93, this partnership formed in late 97, that TRIPA applies. Certainly governs the elements. And certainly this court in, we did not cite it in our opinion, but the court is familiar with Triplex. That case referred to one of those elements, even in joint enterprise arrangement.
Now, one of the elements of TRIPA, as you call it, no particular thing controls. You look at the whole circumstances. It seemed to loosen up the requirements for a partnership. And if that's the case, apparently there's some evidence that Ingram referred to Dr. Deere as a partner.
Yes, Your Honor.
How are we to credit that sort of evidence in light of not giving any particular or not requiring all the indicia of partnership that had been required before?
My first response to that, Your Honor, as we cited in our brief, the mere fact that a party says we're partners is not an evidence of a partnership, because partner is a legal conclusion as well as a factual conclusion. So you have to look at the circumstances in which the partner is referred to.
Well, it does go to the intent element, though.
An expression of an intent to be partners. What Dr. Deere's testimony was that Dr. Ingram referred to him as a partner. He overheard him say so. And Dr. Deere testified, my understanding of partner is people you do work with. Dr. Deere called his employees partners.
Was there any testimony that the two litigants in the trial said, let's form a partnership, let's be partner?
No, Your Honor. Dr. Ingram adamantly opposed that. But we're not arguing about that the court needs to consider a disputed fact in our favor. We're saying just accept what Dr. Deere said. I overheard Ingram say I was his partner. Dr. Deere, what do you understand partner to be? I called my employees partners. I understood partner to be whose works together. But I don't think we have to stop there. My point is the legislature sends five indicators of a partnership. There is no evidence of at least four of those. And we suggest the evidence of the one item, an expression to be partner, is equivocal at best.
Well, there's some indication that Dr. Ingram didn't really contest the existence of an oral partnership arrangement, just questioned the duration of it. And so
Well, Your Honor, I think we win, really, on the at-will nature of the partnership. But we don't agree that there was a partnership. We just agree that Dr. Deere said there was one when he heard a partnership. But in looking at the record, we think the record has to support the existence of a partnership.
But I'm talking more about the waiver point, the preservation point.
Your Honor, the preservation point, virtually all their preservation points go to an evidentiary review and did we object to the charge. In the ultimate answer, in a JNOV, the judge granted the judgment non substantive veredicto. As a result, if there's any basis in the record to justify the judgment notwithstanding the verdict, then the court must affirm the judgment.
So what did the legislature mean? They say, these factors are all ones which this court has said before are mandatory. And now they're saying, well, they're not mandatory. So what in the world do they mean? Why did they do this? You might look at these things. I mean, this reads like a Sandra Day O'Connor opinion. Well, you look at these things, but, you know, it's kind of a feel you get as to when you cross the line. I don't know, when does a partnership exist?
I think that's there's a difficult answer to that question. I think what the legislature was trying to say, and only what the legislature was trying to say, was to respond to case decisions that said if this element is missing, you don't have a business arrangement. And the legislature wanted to encourage business arrangements. And they understood that people who may be very sophisticated, maybe not very sophisticated, maybe just on a handshake deal will put money into an enterprise. And they said, courts, we're not going to find that it's not a partnership just because one or more of these elements are missing. And I think that's a reasonable interpretation. I think it is an unreasonable interpretation where you have direct evidence that none of those elements exist from the witness who's claiming to have a partnership and to say, well, then there's still a partnership.
A couple of the elements. Sharing of profits and sharing of losses or liabilities.
Yes.
If the parties agreed that one-third of the revenue would go to each of them individually and one-third would pay for expenses or costs, why isn't that an indication that they each get a third of the revenue as profits if one-third is going to pay expenses and costs? How do you address that argument?
That was the question Judge Evans was posing to me. Whether I share expenses or not is not sharing losses. I may not have a profit. Therefore, I may have zero money in my pocket, but I'm not liable if I owe more money than I earned. That's a loss. Judge Evans he said, well, they were going to pay their expenses first before you got the profit. Well, first of all, that's not a sharing of losses. That simply is a recognition that until expenses are paid, there is no profit. But the reverse of that is not true. Dr. Deere never said that he would not get his, quote, royalty if the expenses exceeded 80% of the business. He never said that. Now, the judge said, well, because he doesn't get his royalty until after expenses are paid. But if you look at what they say the agreement is, they assumed there would be enough left over for his royalty to be paid. And, in fact, Mr. Ramey never subtracted any expenses before he calculated the 20%. Okay. Gross revenue was gross revenue.
You've talked about losses. Now talk about profits.
Your Honor?
If a business brings in $100 and a third of it pays the costs of the business, then what's left, lay people may call revenue or they may call profit. But if they've set aside money to pay the expenses or the costs, what's left over, someone might call profits. You've addressed the losses side. Address the profits factor.
Your Honor, that's the one thing I think the parties agreed on this way. This was not profit sharing. Dr. Deere was getting a percentage of the gross revenues, a set percentage of the gross revenues. Once renegotiated, that set percentage was 20% of the gross revenues. There was not anticipated, no actual payment of, or even an understanding that he would get 50% or share whatever the profits may be. And so there was no evidence from Dr. Deere that he was sharing profits in this case. All his evidence was I got a royalty. I got a percentage of the gross revenues of this enterprise.
Was there any objection to the jury charge on that first question?
Your Honor, the only objection to the jury charge in the first question was the very last element. I think it was Roman numeral 4 of that element that said that you don't have to share losses if you expressly agree otherwise. I think that was objected to because that was one of the elements of the partnership. There was no other objection to
that. Do you agree that if this court were to find there's some evidence of an expression of intent to form a partnership, then you lose on that Jane O.V. point?
I disagree because I think that standing alone, the fact that the party thought he had a partnership, that standing alone does not justify the jury concluding that there was, in fact, a partnership, considering the total absence of evidence of any other element of partnership.
But outside this case, if there were another trial and there was a factual dispute on expression of intent, that alone would preclude a J&OV, or would it not, without even considering the other factors?
I think, Your Honor, it would be I think the court would be treading on thin ice if it were to declare that merely an expression of a partnership, certainly under the facts of this case, where one party claims the expression.
I'm just looking at the statute, and, you know, there's prior law that, you know, do all these have to exist, or can one exist alone, and that's enough for a partnership? And under the statute, isn't it true that this sort of subjective intent is enough?
I think under the statute, the expression of intent by one party would not be enough under the statute. I think, however, if you had the expression of intent by all the parties, perhaps it would be. I see that my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. We'll hear more from you on rebuttal. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Simpson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. This entire matter can be resolved by this court determining whether a partnership exists.
You have cited a few lines of the record, really, two pages in your brief, and I think that's it. And one of them says, the question was, what did you believe your position to be with respect to a partnership, and the answer was, Dr. Deere's answer, co-owner and associate. And then the other page was, now, doctor, you thought that you were an equal partner in the business. Is that correct? And the answer is yes, and it goes on. Is that all the evidence we have in this record?
I think there's additional evidence, especially because there was testimony about what each was supposed to do and that there was an intent expressed. But more importantly, Your Honor, is they've waived this entirety, if they've admitted that their partnership existed. Because when they were, they never filed a verified defense.
But you tried it by consent.
It doesn't make any difference. It's a verified defense. You can try, excuse me, you can try an affirmative defense by consent. But even if it was tried by consent, that's irrelevant because it's an evidentiary burden. We never had any further burden to put on evidence of the existence of a partnership, although we think there's plenty of evidence
maybe
there.
Maybe the question was there a partnership. That's true. And that was... That's clearly tried by consent.
And again, this is a legal sufficiency issue, and they did not object to that question, so that by them not objecting to that question, they also said there was legally sufficient evidence of a partnership, and of an abundance of caution.
I'm looking at the charge. It says, was there a partnership? And it says the burden's on you to prove it by preponderance of the evidence.
But as a matter...
Who should have objected to that if you thought you win without having to prove anything?
Well,
would have been you, right?
Exactly, but the problem is that as a matter of law, it had already been proven. So as abundance of caution, you go ahead and put it in there.
How had it been proven as a matter of law?
Because they didn't file the verified denial,
Our law is clear on that. If you don't file verified denial, you're right, and you can object at trial. But if nobody objects and it's tried by consent, verified denial is irrelevant. Are you saying that's not the law?
the trial by consent goes to, there's the law and the cases that they cite go to affirmative defenses. You can try by consent. But when you're talking about verified denials, that takes away our evidentiary burden to have to put on the evidence that the partnership existed. And I would appreciate if the court, because there is no law on that particular issue, if the court would look at that particular issue in its opinion. But in addition to that, we have other admissions and waivers, because at the time of the directed verdict, this is a direct quote, and I'm going to page, this is out of the record, volume 6, page 206. This is Mr. Hercules, which was Dr. Ingram's lawyer. And I don't think anybody can seriously argue about the fact that evidence is all over the record about breach of contract and partnership. So I don't make my instructed verdict on those issues. Right there he admitted that there was legally sufficient evidence, which is what is before this court right now.
Okay, but apart from all the waivers, getting back to Justice Heck's first question, are those two pages from the record on partnership all that exists? What else is there?
I think if you take a totality of the record and the agreements, because there was a lot of explanation about what Dr. Deere thought partners were, partners working together. He said that they did work together when he went into when they went to the conference and they were talking about the agreement. You know, he says, no, this isn't the agreement. I'm not going to sign that agreement because I'm also an owner of the business. And he was indicating the joint venture there. There was significant evidence throughout the record that he believed that a joint venture existed. Additionally, though, even his own accountant,
like you have no meeting of the minds here. You have one person saying we have this agreement, another person saying no, it's this agreement. Obviously, it wouldn't reduce to writing, so how can you form a partnership or allege there to be a partnership when you have the two parties involved don't agree to what the partnership is or was?
Well, they can agree. First of all, that is Dr. Ingram's side. Now, if you talk to Dr. Deere, and we're supposed to look at this in the favor of Dr. Deere here, is Dr. Deere testified to him, or we had talked about it for a number of years. He approached me and said we wanted to get together, and we wanted to form this agreement, this joint partnership, this joint venture. I mean, they didn't use those exact words. I mean, there was some testimony at trial, but I mean, as far as in their heads, it didn't seem like they were, you know, but it looked like they wanted a partnership because they intended to work together. They had to have each other to function and to do the work. I mean, one was necessary to the other.
I'm just trying to be clear. In the brief in response says, pages 12 to 13, the record demonstrates that Dr. Deere and Dr. Ingram each owned 50% of the joint venture and each had an equal right to manage and conduct the business of the joint venture, and it cites two pages of the record. And the brief in reply at 5 says those pages don't say that. And all I'm trying to get at, it's kind of unusual for parties at this point to be arguing about what two pages of the record say, but my question to you is there anything else besides these two? And if there is, why didn't you cite it in your brief?
I believe there is more, and it's because I didn't adequately brief it, Your Honor. I'll be glad to, if you would like me to, give you additional specific citations in the record that I do believe support that. But I do believe, since this was, again, I know y'all want to...
It's helpful. I mean, how long was the trial?
The trial was an 8-day trial.
And so to tell us, so it's a stack like this to tell us, well, look at the totality of the circumstances, it's in there somewhere. That's not very helpful.
If the court would like, I'll be glad to go through and give more specific citations, and I apologize for not that.
Specific about an agreement, yes, that's
presumably. But I think the intent alone, I think the clearly intent was in there that was an agreement. And Mr. McClellan, who was Dr. Ingram's accountant, even went back and said he believed that there was an agreement between these two parties. His own, Dr. Ingram's own attorney referred to this as a partnership throughout.
So, I mean, let's presume there is a partnership.
Yes, ma'am.
Why didn't it terminate in March of 1999 when Deere walked out and Ingram said, we're done?
Well, first of all, Deere didn't walk out. Okay. He was at, they came to the meeting. He says, I don't agree to this. I'm not an employee.
Well, he never came back.
I mean, the next week, though, when he was called, he was ready to go back, and then he got another phone call an hour later saying, don't come in.
Well, okay, yeah, all right. Again,
the premises
why
belong-
did that terminate the partnership?
Because the premises belong to Dr. Ingram, and you have to give specific intent. Dr. Deere, specifically, I didn't terminate it. I didn't want to withdraw.
But why didn't
want
Ingram
to go back.
Terminate it? Why didn't that constitute a termination by Ingram of the partnership?
Because Ingram couldn't terminate the partnership. That was okay if he's going to expel Dr. Deere, then he had to specifically state, I'm going to expel. So that it was up to him, or if Dr. Ingram is the one who says, okay, I terminated the partnership. Well, the partnership's not terminated till there's a winding up. There's still not been a winding up.
What's the winding up?
The winding up is the process of determining who owns what. And
Winding up is paying
them out.
Anything other than that?
I think it's paying, making sure all the creditors are paid. And I think if the case...
Winding up is just close those books and we open new ones. We keep doing business. Happens all the time. So why do you get future profits if doesn't the jury's award for past earnings wind up the partnership and that's it?
No, because the jury can't until the date of trial, the jury didn't believe that the partnership had been wound up because the partnership continued ad nauseum. I mean, if Dr. Ingram was trying to withdraw by kicking Dr. Deere out, I mean, here you have the situation, you have two partners.
What happened at trial that made it more clear that they weren't going to continue in business together?
That they weren't going to continue the business?
Yes, ma'am.
Wasn't
it clear from when the petition was filed that says you're not my partner anymore, that they weren't partners anymore?
Well, he didn't say I'm not your partner anymore. He says, I guess we can't do business together. And Dr. Ingram specifically admitted that Dr. Deere never told them that he wanted to withdraw from their agreement or that he ever withdrew. That's directly from Dr. Ingram himself, that he said, no, I'm not going, I don't want this. You know, he said, he admits that Dr. Deere was not the one who said he wanted to end this relationship. Specifically said that. And also...
If Ingram wanted to end the relationship, would it have ended at that point?
I think if Dr. Ingram had specifically sent a letter to Dr. Deere and says, I want to terminate
the
partnership...
Well, now, wait a second. That's not fair.
But no,
The deal is, I get to interrupt because I'm the judge. It may seem unfair, but when you get to be the judge, you can interrupt.
Your Honor.
All right? But the deal is, you can't say, oh, well, they said oral partnership, but the withdrawal had to be in writing. That's not fair.
What I was going to go on to say, I'm sorry I interrupted, but I wanted to finish the statement, was I said, I think if Dr. Ingram had specifically done that, then this would be clear. But what the fact of the matter is...
But if they could join a partnership by saying, let's go into business together, why couldn't they end the partnership by saying, get out?
But the problem here is you have Dr. Ingram that did the getting out. He said, get out. So that's essentially an expulsion rather than a withdrawal. So it's either Dr. Ingram withdrew or he expelled Dr. Deere. You only have two partners here. So therein lies the problem. And if you have a breakdown in the communication here, takes advantage of Dr. Deere and his wonderful reputation, statewide reputation, to build up a business for 15 months. Then when it starts turning significant profits, all of a sudden says, get out. I decided that, you know, it's my premises, you get out. Well, for Dr. Deere to stay would be trespassing for him to come back without permission.
I mean, that argument carried to its logical conclusion would make Texas not an employment at will state because employers do that sometimes. They allegedly take an employee, get the knowledge and get good use out of them and kick them out when they're no longer... But your argument has to be more than that because...
It's a partnership.
What part of the partnership says we can't terminate it at will?
You can't terminate it at will, but you still have to follow the steps of the Texas Revised Partnership Act. And if I can analogize to family law, which is what I am most comfortable with, you got a husband and a wife. You can't just end it by saying, get out, honey, or get out, husband. Can't do that. You have to go through the steps that we require in the state of Texas, which is you have to file that petition, you have to get that divorce, and you have to wind up the marriage.
You don't have to get a court order to end a partnership. You do to get into marriage.
Okay. But in this, the TRPA still requires you to take certain steps, and that's why the analogy is that you have to take...
step other than paying me the value of my half of the partnership.
Well, that's what he had to do. Well, he had to show the books and account for that. They kept asking for the books.
We've got a jury finding. What he was owed was $34,000. Why isn't that it?
We disagree on the accounting in some of the books. We don't disagree. I think we're both in agreement on that the tax return showed certain things for those months. But even that information wasn't given to us until 2002. So you don't, underneath the Partnership Act doesn't end until you wind up the partnership, and it doesn't terminate till you wind up the partnership. And that was part of the problem, is the jury didn't believe that it was terminated in March of 99, even though Dr. Deere left, because the partnership continued as is. It has gone on. It was existing at the time of trial. It still, to my knowledge, exists today. And I hate to beat the dead horse, but I want to make one more point on the waiver, because what their case that they've cited in the brief does not support that, and this was not raised in the second motion for JNOV.
Okay. Why would they have raised this objection when they won? The trial judge at the end of all the JNOVs said judgment for them. They would have had no reason to preserve after that.
They didn't raise it in the second motion for JNOV, and the JNOV was granted only on the grounds stated in the JNOV. That's what the order says. Granted on the grounds stated. This was not a ground on which the JNOV was granted. Therefore, they have not preserved it. So for all the other reasons they haven't preserved, they didn't preserve it on that reason.
But I'm just wondering how they would have. The trial judge says, okay, granted. It's a take nothing verdict for the defendant. Thanks very much, Judge. Now, I need to preserve my error on the other reasons that what you just did is right. We wouldn't. What would be the sense?
But their whole challenge is they've granted it on the fact that they're claiming it was granted because there was legal insufficiency that the partnership existed, but they didn't raise it.
My point is the record's not closed. If they still have time to file another JNOV, another motion for new trial, they can raise new points and preserve error, even if that's the first time. But once you've won everything, there's no reason to keep doing that.
But they didn't win everything, because if a partnership exists under the TRPA on its face, there's a fiduciary duty. And they never challenged. They have not challenged in this court and not brought before this court that if there's a partnership exists and there's a fiduciary duty as a result of that partnership, they have not challenged the damages related to that breach of fiduciary duty.
How do you read this statute? It says we look at these five factors, but a couple of them listed down here don't disqualify it. So how many do you have to have to be a partnership?
I think you can have one. You can have one alone, I think the intent alone. But here you have share, it says share of profits. Well, and share of losses. Well, what is the profit? They decide one-third, one-third, one-third. As the Justice pointed out earlier, to me that's one-third was supposed to set those expenses. And then Dr. Ingram comes to Dr. Deere and says, wait a minute, my practice is gone, my wife's practice is gone, and would you reduce? Well, then he reduced to 20%. So now there's 80%.
I'm trying to, this is a new statute. It's changed the rules of partnership. I'm trying to figure out, not in your case, but in general, how we're going to work this. Now, if it's just one of them, for instance, participation or right to participate in control of the business, if that alone is enough, doesn't that would convert every corporation into a partnership?
Well, as I said before, I think you have to have kind of a...
It can't be.
Right. You can have a totality of the circumstances, what were each of them responsible for, which were each of them supposed to do.
How many does that mean of these I need to be the totality of the circumstances?
I think that's going to be a fact determination, obviously, in each case.
So really, your argument is you don't really know whether you have a partnership till the jury comes back with the verdict.
Finder fact, yes. I mean, well, on its face, obviously, it's
rather shocking,
well,
isn't it?
If you have, obviously, it's the oral partnerships that are causing the problem, because if you have a written partnership, we never get there. So if you have the oral partnership again, yes, I think that the court needs to come out. What do you need? What do you need to get to where you're going to go? Because it's going to be helpful in the future. Because I think we have a lot. I don't think it's the mom-and-pop partnerships we're having the problem with. Obviously, if it's the 100 partner law firms, we're not, you know, everybody's got a written agreement.
Right,
everything's in writing. It's when you have these oral situations. And I would suggest to the court a case that I've cited in my brief, N. Ray Leal. It's out of the Southern District, the bankruptcy court. I actually think they do a very good job of going through this situation. There was an oral partnership. It was kind of loosey-goosey. One did the work, the sweat equity. One contributed all the money. They traded off on who was doing the books. But that's the case that I found most thorough that actually did some analysis of this, not only on the partnership issue, although they stated some things, which it was somewhat analogous to the situation here, and then they hit the fiduciary duty issue.
Counsel,
for reasons. Yes, sir.
Where did Ramey get, your expert, get his numbers?
And from their
book. For some of the years, they were, it looks like, almost twice the actual revenues that he used to base his damages figures on.
He got it from looking at their books and records, and what he concluded was during the first 2 years it increased by 14.2%, and he, about 30% of his own practice was doctors, chiropractors, psychologists, these, you know, clinic-type businesses. He said in his experience that he believed from, he couldn't trust the records. Part of the problem was we had tax returns for 98-99. There were no tax returns presented after that, and he called into question a lot of the books and records. So what he was trying to do is project, I don't think it's going to continue at a 14% growth rate. My experience is the 10% based upon the records, that the limited records I've seen and that were produced to me and the questions that I had, I think that this is a justifiable increase for each year.
Well, if you assume a 14% increase, then you go from 2000 where the actual revenue was about $1.2 million to 2001, where your expert's projection was $2 million. That's an $800,000 increase. That's a lot more than 14%. And petitioner asserts that the revenues actually declined, not increased. So your 10% or 14% is going in the wrong direction. Where'd your expert get his numbers?
Well, this is his numbers, the numbers that he was going by, he started, and we had hard numbers for 98-99 because we had tax returns. And he figured they wouldn't lie on the tax returns. So he took that last number, and then he added, multiplied it by, you know, did 10% of that number, added 10%, added, and 10% added. That's where he got the numbers. And
why didn't he use the actual revenues?
Well, that was the problem. Although they say the revenue, the money, the numbers were given, we say that they were not. And we called into question a great deal about the books and records. And the testimony that Dr. Ingram's accountant gave was really conclusory because he just says that was the actual number. He didn't produce a tax return. He didn't produce books and records to the jury.
When you say they say, I assume you mean petitioners,
yes,
that the numbers were given, what does that mean?
It says, Mr. McClellan testified.
What the actual revenues were?
Mr. McClellan's accountant simply testified the actual revenues were 1.2. The actual revenues were 1.4. Introduced no backup. Never said where he got those. He says these are the actual numbers and these are the numbers he should have used. But those numbers weren't furnished to Mr. Ramey. He said I didn't have those numbers.
So you say the actual revenues by the petitioner aren't accurate, but your expert based his numbers on numbers from the petitioner's expert.
We based our numbers.
Sounds like you're saying neither side's numbers were accurate, but that doesn't help support your position that your expert is accurate.
No, we based our numbers on the first 2 years where there were tax returns, and there was no dispute what the tax returns said. And that's where we started with our initial numbers, and then he had to estimate and project out so that he could, from his experience and from his background, from what he could tell from the records. And I see my time's expired.
Yes, are there any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Simpson.
Mr. Annie, can you respond to this waiver issue? Whether or not you waived
about
that
the partnership on the motion to trial, we did cite a case that said when the judge grants the JNOV judgment notwithstanding the verdict, the obligation of the appellate court is to affirm it on any grounds. And what we have said throughout is there is no evidence supporting any of the jury findings in this case, and that includes partnership. In answer to Justice Johnson's question about an objection to the charge on the partnership questions, our exhibit before the court matches up the evidence in the record against the indicators that the charge uses. So we accept the charge and its definition of what the indicators are and demonstrate there's no evidence of those. So we're not attacking the charge itself.
If you agree to be compensated one-third, one-third, one-third out of revenue, that means if the business makes nothing, you make nothing. Why is that not sort of a sweat equity sort of contribution?
Your Honor, if that were Dr. Deere's testimony, I'd say he'd had some evidence of sweat equity. That was not his testimony. His testimony was it was one-third of gross revenues. Now, what he talked about is we anticipated a third of it.
But I'm not talking about profits. I'm just saying if you've got a loose relationship and you say, look, I'm not going to take anything out unless we have something in. If it makes $100, I'll take 33 and a half, whatever the gross revenues are. But if it makes nothing, so aren't you risking, you're taking some risk that the business will not do well. I don't understand why, whether you tag it to profit or revenue, it has anything to do with whether you've agreed to contribute sweat equity.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, we have not briefed that particular question, but I do believe in partnership law there's a question about sweat equity versus compensated for your sweat. In other words, if I was going to build that house and you were going to give me $100,000 to build the house, and then we sold the house, and it generated X dollars over and above what the investor put in it, we'd split it 50-50, my sweat equity would be the equity put into the house. But if my compensation for providing medical services will be 20% of the gross revenues of the business that I'm working for, I'm being paid for my time. I have not contributed capital at all to the business. I'm simply being paid for my time. And that was the issue that was difficult in this one.
Because
his compensation for his time as the doctor.
But the business couldn't have operated without him. You had to have a medical director.
That really is kind of a confusing part that I think Dr. Deere plays on. This business was in operation for a number of years. There is an aspect of the business, full services, that requires a licensed medical physician in order to prescribe and complete the process. The clinic was an active, ongoing operation when Dr. Deere was invited to be the medical director to provide a part of those services. Those services, which goes to the question about abandonment, we accept on JNOV that we fired Mr. Deere or we asked him to leave the partnership, although that's disputed by Dr. Ingram, but let's accept that's the case. But the reason he was there is because for the services we were trying to provide required a medical doctor. We could go get another medical doctor to do that and be a part of this. But he left, never to return, but claims he's entitled to 20% of the gross revenues of an operation.
How did the tax returns treat this relationship?
Your Honor, that's an interesting question. The tax returns simply showed the gross revenues of the clinic. Dr. Ingram was responsible for that. This was not a sharing of the records. This was not a sharing of the bookkeeping. Dr. Ingram handled all the bookkeeping, all the administration, hired and fired all the employees.
So Dr. Deere's salary was or compensation was expensed out of that?
His compensation was I don't know how it was expensed in the tax returns. What I know is that the records that Mr. McClellan used were the tax returns for the years that he had the actual income that Ramey only projected. And as Ramey said, Ramey used the tax returns for 97 and 98. So the evidence was all the same about what the gross revenues of the clinic was. Of course, one of the assumptions by Dr. Ramey was that he was also including income from rehabilitation services. And as Dr. Deere said, he knew nothing about rehabilitation services, didn't do any work for rehabilitation services. I wanted to address one part of this on paid. The jury verdict did count March 99 as being significant. It said it was unpaid. The undisputed evidence is after Dr. Ingram excused Dr. Deere. Dr. Ingram looked at the income, wrote out a check for $34,247.68 and sent it to Dr. Deere, who received it. For these reasons, we think the judge's judgment should be affirmed.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.